This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Ayatollah Khamenei says the United States intensified its Iranophobia and Shia phobia campaign only after Tehran frustrated all of its criminal schemes. Hamas says the Palestinian anti-Israeli operations are a natural response to the regime's occupation and crimes. Also ahead, Russia warns the United States that it is risking direct engagement in the war by supplying Ukraine with long-range weapons. Hello and welcome from our headquarters in Tehran. Thank you for joining us. My name is Kisum Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says encouraging other nations to stand up against bullying is one of the reasons of the enmity of arrogant powers towards Iran. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei described the United States as the head of the arrogant front. He said neutralizing America's criminal plots in different countries such as Daesh led to widespread Iranophobia and Shia phobia campaigns, as well as accusations that Iran is interfering in other countries. The leader emphasized that Iran does not interfere in other countries, saying that such accusations emanate from those who want to prevent significant progress of the Islamic system. Ayatollah Khamenei said the policy of the arrogant powers is to paint an unrealistic dividing lines with the Islamic world. The leader added that a recent incitement and planning for war between Shia and Sunni, Arab and non-Arab, or even intra-Shia and intra-Sunni conflicts are the policy of the United States. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei was addressing the participants of the 7th Congress of Ahlul Bayt World Assembly in Tehran. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has praised an anti-Israeli operation in the occupied West Bank city of Al-Khalil. Hamas further expressed condolences to the family of the man who was gunned down by Israeli forces following this operation. The movement also called for more attacks on Israeli troops and settlers. Tel Aviv claims that a Palestinian man was shot dead after stabbing an Israeli soldier. Meanwhile, scuffles broke out between Israeli troops and Palestinians who were trying to help the wounded man. Regime forces hurled sound grenades and fired tear gas to prevent them from reaching the Palestinian man. Israeli military has recently stepped up deadly raids across the occupied territories. Political activist Moti Abu Musabi says that Palestinians have no choice but to defend themselves against Israeli atrocities in the wake of the international community's inaction to hold the regime accountable for its crimes.
I think it has become a matter of fact that Israel considers itself as an above the law state. And this is mainly because, and basically because of the impunity given by the international community and by the ongoing and the blind support of the United States administrations that gives the total support for the Israeli occupation without any kind of accountability or without holding the Israeli occupation accountable for committing those crimes and those attacks. Today, the Palestinian people actually is paying the price of that kind of abhorrent silence of the international community. Today, the blood of the Palestinian children and the blood of the Palestinian civilians actually is on the hand of the international community and the United States administrations. And I think today, and without having any kind of sanctions and any kind of holding the Israeli occupation accountable for its crimes, Israel will keep committing its crimes. Therefore, the Palestinian people have no choice but to resist the Israeli occupation with all means available.
A Palestinian inmate held in Israeli jails near the occupied West Bank city of Bethlehem has died due to deliberate medical negligence by prison authorities. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has condemned this as a crime and a violation of all humanitarian norms and laws. Our correspondent Mona Kendall tells us more.
Musa Abu Mohammed, 40 years old, a Palestinian man from the town of Beit Tamar in Bethlehem, was held by the Israeli forces, and he was arrested several months ago, according to the Israelis, because he was caught in Al-Quds without having Israeli issued permit. It's prohibited and it's banned for Palestinians living in the occupied West Bank to enter the land occupied in 1948 without Israeli issued permits. Anyways, this Palestinian man was sick, according to his family, and his health condition deteriorated several weeks ago, but he was transferred to hospital Asaf Harafe 3 days ago, and unfortunately this morning he passed away inside the Israeli hospital, of course, due to medical negligence. He was sick, his health deteriorated, and the Israelis didn't give him the needed medical medications, or even they didn't transfer him to hospital on time. After 3 days in the Israeli hospital, he passed away.
Welcome to another edition of the News Review. In this edition, Russia once again warns the United States against providing Ukraine with long-range weapons, saying that Washington is almost becoming a direct party to the conflict.
We are warning the U.S. against taking provocative steps, such as deliveries of longer-range and more devastating weapons. It's a road to nowhere fraught with grave consequences, the responsibility for which will lie entirely on Washington.
The Russian deputy foreign minister also underlined his country's military doctrine that allows it to use nuclear weapons in case of foreign aggression or an existential threat. He said Moscow would push ahead with its offensive in Ukraine until all of its goals are achieved. The U.S. has sent several batches of heavy weapons to Ukraine. Most recently, it provided Kiev with more high-mobility multiple rocket launches, or HIMARS, which have significantly strengthened the capability of the Ukrainian army. The missiles supplied to Kiev have a range of up to 80 kilometers, but the U.S. has expressed its intention to supply those with a range of more than 300 kilometers. Russia has time and again said that the West, the U.S. in particular, are prolonging the war by arming Ukraine. Now, to discuss that further, we're joined by Marcus Papadopoulos, historian and political analyst and author, who's joining us from London, and also Mr. John Stepling, author and commentator from Norway. Let's begin with Mr. Papadopoulos. It sounds like a serious warning from Russia, doesn't it, about the U.S. taking a risk of becoming a direct party to the war with its nonstop flow of destructive weapons to Ukraine. How serious do you see this threat?
Well, it should be said, first of all, that there is no tangible evidence to demonstrate that the HIMARS are having an adverse impact on the ability of the Russian military to prosecute its campaign in Ukraine. Indeed, for the HIMARS to have a relatively significant role in the war in Ukraine, the Ukrainian armed forces would have to be in receipt of hundreds of the systems. But even then, the harsh reality for Zelensky and his government in Kiev is that the Ukrainian armed forces are being outled, outmaneuvered, outgunned, outmanned, and out-financed by the Russians. Anyone who is of the impression that either Ukraine can win this war or can achieve a stalemate quite simply is deluded, and I suspect deluded because they are exposing themselves on a daily basis to the grotesque deceit emanating from Western mainstream media. Now, regarding the role of America in this war, from day one of the Russian military's campaign in Ukraine, the Americans have been a party to the conflict. A substantial amount of the weaponry which has been employed by the Ukrainian army, either against Russian servicemen or against Russian civilians in, for example, the city of Belgorod, is of American origin. Therefore, the argument that America is becoming more and more involved in this conflict is, in my opinion, a peculiar one. But the most important reality in all of this is the following. The high commands of Russia and America and the commands of the nuclear forces of Russia and America are in daily contact with each other. And that is absolutely imperative for preventing a conflict, a direct conflict between America and Russia. Now, that reality is not something you will hear about from Western mainstream media, simply because that, in the views of Western mainstream journalists, is not a very exciting news story. Western mainstream media, people in Britain and America, for example, to believe that a nuclear Armageddon between America and Russia is imminent, when the reality is that the Americans and the Russians, despite what is happening in Ukraine, remain in direct contact with each other, as they have since the end of the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962.
Okay, so Mr. Stapling, there is also very sensitive issue of the nuclear power plant in Ukraine. The IAEA chief says the agency's inspectors have been giving unlimited access to the nuclear plant, and despite Ukraine's insistence that Russians have distorted facts and evidence, how concerned should we be about the likelihood of a nuclear disaster from that facility?
Well, I think it's a concern, certainly, but what Mark has said is exactly right. It's important to emphasize that Western media has become simply a propaganda machine. I mean, the distance between reality in Ukraine and what Western media reports is gigantic. The Western public is, if they simply read the mainstream press in the U.S. and U.K. and actually much of Europe, is going to have a very different picture of what's going on in Ukraine than what is actually happening there. The other thing that, you know, the Biden just this week, and Congress, you know, rubber stamped, I think, something like another several billion dollars worth of weapons going to Ukraine. Much of this weaponry is ending up in the black market. There have been numerous reports of the, you know, the plundering of aid and weaponry to Ukraine by this kind of gangster regime in Kiev. It's a profoundly corrupt government, and everybody knows this. The United States knows it, but that hasn't stopped them because, you know, the defense industry is the number one industry in the world, and they make enormous profits from this. I'm not worried. As Marcus said, I'm not worried either about a, you know, nuclear Armageddon. I mean, one always worries, but I think there are saner minds involved than the people in the White House and in Kiev. And Russia has been actually extraordinarily restrained in their responses to these provocations. The Russian ambassador to the U.S. yesterday said the U.S. simply continues to pour oil on the fire. And it's true, the U.S. has rejected every single effort at some sort of settlement or peace agreement or cessation of aggression. They have undermined everything, and they provoked this war. They wanted this war. They continue to want this war, and it's unwinnable. They're not going to win. Ukraine has suffered just this week massive numbers of casualties, but you don't hear a word about that in the Western press. So, you know, Ukraine may keep getting weapons, but they are running out of soldiers. And meanwhile, the U.S., you know, domestically is suffering increased unrest, unprecedented homelessness, unemployment. Now there is a meme going around about a, you know, upcoming civil war, but it's not all that far-fetched. There is extraordinary dissatisfaction with Biden, with the direction of U.S. foreign policy, the direction of U.S. domestic policy. Biden's approval ratings are something like 30%. I mean, that's very, very low. And then he gave a very menacing and kind of lurid speech, stage-managed speech against a red backdrop the other night that suggested a kind of a Nazi-like stage decor. It's all very strange. His press secretary increasingly makes provocative comments. So the leadership in the U.S. just increasingly feels unhinged and disoriented. And Russia, as I say, has been very restrained. And this entire conflict can be laid at the feet of the U.S. So the reports about the nuclear facility are, you know, it's hard to tweeze apart fact from fiction, and certainly it's impossible if you're reading simply the Western press. But I don't think it's a significant issue right at the moment.
Thank you very much, Mr. John Stepling, author and commentator from Norway, and Marcus Papadopoulos, historian and political analyst and author from London. Thanks for sharing your thoughts and views with us on this edition of the News Review. And thanks to you all for following us.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Aperture.
The birth and development of the American police can be traced to a multitude of historical, legal, and political economic conditions. The institution of slavery and the control of minorities, however, were two of the more formidable historic features of American society shaping early policing. Slave patrols and night watches, which later became modern police departments, were both designed to control the behaviors of minorities. Slave patrols helped to maintain the economic order and to assist the wealthy landowners in recovering and punishing slaves who essentially were considered property. Though many years have passed from the abolishment of slavery, police brutality is the enduring legacy of slavery in the U.S. I'm Zarin Shajari, and this is Aperture. In response to the sustained and increasingly visible violence against black communities in the U.S., the Black Lives Matter movement took shape. The movement campaigns against police violence and systematic racism towards African Americans. People from all walks of life in the Black Lives Matter campaign regularly protest police killings of black people and broader issues of racial profiling, police brutality, and racial inequality in the United States criminal justice system. Stay with us as this documentary talks to activists, specialists, and family members of police brutality victims to depict the true picture of systematic injustice and racism in the heart of American society. Don't go away. Here's the first part.
Garner went unconscious.
Cops used a chokehold that allegedly led to Eric Garner's death.
Me and my brothers and sisters sat around the computer, watched the video, and it changed our lives forever. I couldn't stop wondering why. I was screaming at the TV.
His death not being called a homicide.
In a matter of seconds, you see him, you know, being killed, murdered right before our eyes.
A Staten Island grand jury has decided not to indict an NYPD officer in the death of a man on Staten Island.
They said that they are going to be out here every night marching until they get an indictment in the death of Eric Garner. There is just as much anger out here tonight, just as much passion.
You see these police officers in riot gear trying to hold this position at Camden and Howard. The protesters are basically right in their faces.
Seeing a scene with African-American protesters facing police in riot gear. These men and women.
Protesters in Minneapolis have attempted to shut down the city's airport this afternoon. The group representing the Black Lives Matter movement blocked two roads outside a terminal before state police ordered the group to disperse.
Back to the situation in downtown Los Angeles. Looks like protesters have moved now onto the 101 freeway in downtown.
Earlier in the day, organizers of the group promised that a demonstration involving hundreds of protesters would shut down the Mall of America.
You know, I don't remember the kind of life before what's going on. Like, you know, all of my activities have to do with basically what we call the revolution. You kind of just dive in it head first. It's like, so you can't stop. And, you know, I feel like if I stop this time, I can no longer complain about anyone that's murdered unarmed after, you know, Akai Gurley and Eric Garner and Mike Brown. So I have to keep going with this. Martin Luther King, I mean, he was in the movement for 13 years before he was assassinated. So it's not something that's going to be overnight. The significance to me of Black Lives Matter is that it's something that's nationwide. It's not just a New York problem, it's a New Jersey problem, it's across the United States. And, you know, Black Lives Matter is basically calling attention that, hey, you know, you say that all lives matter, and yes, all lives matter, but black lives aren't mattering right now. So that's what we're trying to let you guys know is, hey, you know, hi, Black Lives Matter. You know, we're being kind of hunted, and it's a little bit of a pattern. At first, you know, people could say maybe it was a coincidence, but now it's just a pattern. And it's almost like every year there's some, you know, publicly broadcasted, you know, murder of an unarmed African-American or brown person.
Well, I moved to New York in November for work. I'm an attorney. I work in banking and financial compliance, but I've always been really active outside of work in, like, activists and social justice missions. And I don't think people want to confront the issue that there's an issue with our system, that our police, not all of them, but there are some within those ranks, are brutalizing and terrorizing American citizens. And so I believe in our Constitution. I do believe in our criminal justice system. I think it, you know, it has the potential to be a great system, but the corruption within it and the bias within it makes it a very dangerous system for Black and brown people.
Our justice system is not corrupt. It's just very decentralized in comparison to other democratic countries. And when it's decentralized, it's based on a variety of standards for people who are part of the system. And some of the standards are not as high as we would like them to see. And then people paint with a very broad brush, extrapolating from one jurisdiction to another. Definitely we have race issues in our society, not just in the United States, in many other countries. Police officers are recruited from the society and from the community. So there's no doubt in my mind that some of the officers have various biases.
On February 26, 2012, in Sanford, Florida, Trayvon Martin, an unarmed 17-year-old high school student coming home from a nearby convenience store, was fatally shot by George Zimmerman, a neighborhood watch captain. Martin died from a single gunshot wound to the chest. When police arrived at the scene, Zimmerman admitted that he shot Martin, but he claimed he had acted in self-defense. No charges were initially brought against Zimmerman. It was not until the shooting garnered national attention that Zimmerman was charged in connection with Martin's death. In July 2013, a jury acquitted Zimmerman of all charges. Upon the not guilty verdict, there were protests nationwide in more than 100 cities. President Obama said that he identified with the boy. Trayvon Martin could have been me 35 years ago.
Why was it that Trayvon tended to fizzle out? But one reason was because he got all of that rage that was finally manifest, but it was geared toward what? Laws, stand your ground. It wasn't geared toward the powers that be. It wasn't geared toward the federal government. It wasn't geared toward the White House. It was geared toward state laws. Well, why is that so? Well, that's exactly what the powers that be wanted it to be. You see, the president's office, what did he do? He sent his own extension, who was Sharpton. And Sharpton gives a great speech, and it's all about state laws rather than police going to jail. Everybody knows that you're not going to change arbitrary police power until policemen start going to jail. Why is it that in the last 7 years you haven't had one policeman go to jail? It's the same reason why you haven't had one Wall Street executive go to jail. Because the government doesn't want them to go to jail. The government don't want to put power in that direction to go to jail. You can rest be assured, if you had a massive network of poor people engaged in gangster activity like Wall Street did with market manipulation and insider trading, those folk gonna get caught and go to jail. You can rest be assured that the police were killing well-to-do white folk. Some policemen's going to jail. It's a priority. It's not a priority of the U.S. government to send policemen to jail. Not until it starts affecting them in the way it already affects many of us. And you see, some of us believe that the life of a poor black person, a poor brown person, has exactly the same value as that of a well-to-do white or well-to-do black or anybody else of the upper class.
We did have officers jailed for excessive force, especially in we had a case, an infamous case in Charleston in South Carolina, when the officer shot an individual in his back, and he's right now in prison. The judicial system is not designed to avoid prosecution of police officers, but because the standard is a standard of discretion of the individual police officer, and the standard is based on, again, individual perceptions of the situations. It appears sometimes that there is injustice because we look at this behavior in hindsight, and for us, it appears as excessive. But for the officer, at the given moment on the street, it wasn't excessive, and the jurors frequently accept the word of the officer.
There is growing outrage tonight after an unarmed African-American teenager was shot and killed by police in the St. Louis suburb of Ferguson, Missouri.
There was a struggle, and one of the men pushed the officer into his car.
Within the police car, there was a struggle over the officer's weapon. There was at least one shot fired within the car.
The struggle spilled out onto the street, where Brown, whom investigators say was not armed, was fatally shot.
Police have shot this man for no reason.
A little more than a year later, Michael Brown, an 18-year-old unarmed African-American man, was shot and killed in Ferguson, Missouri, a northern suburb of St. Louis. Brown, who had stolen several packages of cigarillos from a nearby convenience store shortly before the shooting, was confronted by 28-year-old Darren Wilson, a white Ferguson police officer. The disputed circumstances of the Brown shooting sparked unrest in the majority black city, and protests erupted. The events received considerable attention in the U.S. and elsewhere, and generated a vigorous debate about the relationship between law enforcement and African Americans, as well as the use of force by police in Missouri and across the nation.
In Ferguson, Michael Brown case, it's the word of the police officer, and we don't have any footage. The only footage that we have is what happened before at the convenience store. The footage at the convenience store is not very, positive in terms of how I look at this. It shows somebody who is acting very aggressively within the convenience store, and it gives me an indication that there was some level of violence that was displayed.
The Black Lives Matter movement focuses primarily on the experience of black men and has shaped the conversation about police brutality, where it occurs, and how it's addressed. But black women are also being killed, assaulted, and victimized by police. Women are often targeted in the same way as men, through shootings, police stops, and racial profiling. A growing number of Black Lives Matter activists, including the women behind the original hashtag, have been refocusing attention on how African-American women and other marginalized communities are treated by the police. They're not only highlighting the impact racial discrimination has on their communities, but articulating why a movement for racial justice must be inclusive. Women have been at the forefront of organizing marches, die-ins, protests, and various initiatives to have their voices heard. Young African-American women have been playing a central role.
Cigarettes.
Let's arrest them. Let's have them go before a jury of his peers, and let's use the system the way it's supposed to be used. Cops are not supposed to be the judge, jury, and executioner. That's the end of the story, really.
Like, say hypothetically one or two of these shootings are justified. They don't even give us that opportunity to think, critically about it, because regardless of what happens with the situation, they're not held accountable, which is the part that bothers me the most. It's like, regardless of what's happening, if it's a little boy, unarmed, kid sleeping, a grown man, selling cigarettes, no matter what the police does to them, they're not being held accountable for it.
And there's no data. That's another big issue that I think when we have the demands, because I like Esther's, her list of demands, they kind of just echo what everyone's kind of feeling in the movement. But there needs to be data, because why can't we find any, data about how many police-involved shootings, how many fatalities, how many were armed, how many weren't armed? We need that kind of information.
That's a serious issue. I think we need to really capitalize on like the momentum that we have here, and definitely use that to engage the young people, because those are the people who are going to make a change. And that's why we have to do this at a local level. You know what I'm saying? We have to focus locally. And I think like our demonstrations, the vigil being one of them, is a good way to do that. You know what I'm saying? Just re-engage people on a local level and then help them to see that we can make change. So thank you guys, as always, for going out and supporting Erica night after night. I mean, we do that weekly, on a weekly basis, two nights a week. So when one of us can't get there, I appreciate that somebody is there to support her.
There. Yeah. And she needs that consistency.
Absolutely.
On July 17th, 2014, almost 1 year after George Zimmerman was acquitted in connection with the shooting death of Trayvon Martin, Eric Gardner, a 43-year-old father of six, died of a heart attack while in police custody. He was being arrested when a New York Police Department officer, Daniel Pantaleo, put Gardner in a chokehold. Gardner was arrested on a Staten Island street corner on suspicion of selling untaxed cigarettes. After Gardner resisted being arrested, Pantaleo pulled Gardner to the ground by the neck and placed him into a fatal chokehold. In a cell phone video taken by a passerby, Gardner, who suffered from chronic asthma and heart problems, repeatedly says, "I can't breathe," 11 times in total. This video has been viewed more than 2.5 million times. A grand jury declined to indict Officer Pantaleo, and he remains with the NYPD.
On July 17th, my father was out here just like another regular day, you know, talking with his friends. That day, I was at work. I worked in Long Island at that time. I got a call from my mom. I was talking to my mom. And then about 5-10 minutes after I got off the phone with my mom, my sister calls, and she's like, you know, she don't know what's going on. She's all, my mom is, you know, all hysterical, crying. She don't know what's going on. They just said, "Dad, just stop breathing." So she started calling, you know, the hospital, trying to figure out what was going on. We couldn't get no information in from the phone. They called her and told her, you know, that it was something that went down and my dad stopped breathing. You know, she didn't know that it had anything to do with the cops until she got to the hospital. And so by the time we came to Staten Island, me, my aunt, and my cousins, you know, we drove past this part of where it happened, and we seen a whole bunch of news vans and yellow tape, and we still didn't know what was going on. So we got to my grandmother's house, and that's when a reporter from the Daily News was there, and he told us, you know, it was a confrontation with the cops, and there's a video, and would you guys like to see it before it goes out on the internet, and would you give us permission to let it go out? And me and my brothers and sisters sat around the computer, watched the video, and it changed our lives forever. I couldn't stop. Like, I couldn't stop wondering why, you know. I was screaming at the TV, because, you know, in a matter of seconds, you see him, you know, being killed, murdered right before our eyes, and it was just horrible for us to see. I mean, we couldn't go into the living room and describe what we seen on the TV, on the computer, to our grandparents or to my mother, because it was so horrible. Like, I was sick that day. I mean, I just, you know, my whole body, it was just like shaky. I just couldn't believe. And then when me and my aunt was driving back to Brooklyn, we stopped over here after all the cops left and everything. And people noticed me. I never been to Staten Island like that. Like, I stayed in Brooklyn.
But my father used to talk a lot about me and his granddaughter. And when they noticed my face, that I looked like my dad, you know, the love was just pouring out. You know, people was telling me their versions of the story, and it was just like, wow. I still can't believe this happened.
The Eric Garner case is problematic in the sense that experts in martial arts and some other people who specialize in takedowns of individuals believe that this was more of a takedown than a chokehold. Part of the problem is the patrol guide or operating procedures, standard operating procedures of NYPD that were very broad. They were changing now. The use of force procedures have been changed since Eric Garner case.
A recent study on children, published in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology, found that black boys as young as 10 are more likely to be mistaken as being older, be thought of as guilty of possible crimes, and face police violence if accused of a crime. According to a ProPublica analysis of federally collected data on fatal police shootings, young black males were 21 times more likely to have been shot dead by police than their white counterparts. The 1,217 deadly police shootings from 2010 to 2012 captured in the federal data show that black males, ages 15 to 19, died at the hands of police at a rate of 31.17 per million. White males in the same age range were killed at a rate of just 1.47 per million.
Tonight, it was a case that sparked outrage across the nation and heartbreak here in Cleveland. 12-year-old Tamir Rice playing with a gun outside a rec center. The gun turned out to be fake, and he was shot to death by a rookie police officer who says that he thought it was real. Now the Cuyahoga County prosecutor has released three brand new reports on this shooting just within the past few hours. One is from the Highway Patrol. The other two are from experts asked to weigh in on this case months ago. They both found that the officer was justified. So who are these experts and how did they reach this decision?
In November 2014, 12-year-old Tamir Rice was shot and killed by a police officer in Cleveland, Ohio. Two officers, Timothy Lohman and Frank Garnback, were responding to a 911 call reporting that a man in a neighborhood park was walking around with what was described as probably a fake gun. Just 1.5 seconds after arriving on the scene, Officer Lohman shot and killed Rice. The boy had been playing with what was later identified as an airsoft pellet gun. A video obtained by the Northeast Ohio Media Group shows Rice's 14-year-old sister running over to her brother, being tackled and forced to the ground, handcuffed, and placed in a patrol car while her brother lay dying. The video also shows that police waited 4 minutes before providing any first aid to Rice. On June 3, 2015, the county sheriff's office released a statement saying their investigation had been completed, with their findings turned over to the county prosecutor. A grand jury later declined to indict Officer Lohman.
When we talk about law enforcement, we talk about 18,000 different police departments in the United States. Most of the departments that I'm familiar with, they don't have specific training for police officers to deal with minors and toy guns. It's mentioned during sometimes roll call, sometimes during the basic academy, that of course there's a possibility, but again, police officers are like any other people. They fear. They have fear. They have more fear probably than an average person because they also see situations that are much more dangerous and horrific than an average person. They're not taught or trained how to control their fears.
You know, Black Lives Matter is a multiracial movement. Because if Black Lives Matter, then all lives will matter. Because usually it's the Black lives that are the last ones that have value.
Even with
within our own nation, the consciousness has been raised. People were preaching about colorblindness. They realized that there are race issues that are still permeate our society.
I don't want my children to experience it. You know, I don't want them to grow up being afraid or teaching them to be afraid of police.
There is just as much anger out here.
These police officers in riot gear trying to hold this position at Camden and Howard.
This is
For a Better Life.
For a Better Life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله. Dear listeners, the audience of your very favorite program, For a Better Life, you're listening to IRB English Radio. This is Asma, your friend, and we're going to have a heart-to-heart whisper regarding the literature of Ashura. On previous session of For a Better Life, we talked about some special sort and form and type of plays that are called taziyeh, which is literally meaning mourning or condolence. So we said that in those sort of plays, you get to see the scenes, actually a touch of this scenes that happened in the battlefield of Karbala and what happened to the family member of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. So you get to have this outburst of emotion and passion toward the family and companion of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. So it gives you this very amazing pleasure of beholding the scenes with your eyes, and then your heart will be filled with too much of sorrows as if you're beholding it. And all the time throughout the play, as you're just watching it, you wish that, oh God, I wish I was there in order to lend some helping hand in that battlefield and to join the army of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. So this process of sympathizing with the story of Karbala does not need actually those plays and scenes in order to make you feel it. But through these sort of visual things and through these artistic formats that are presented in the Islamic literature, we could have some different experiences. These are just another ways. These are just some different tools for us to connect to the main ideas and the themes that went on behind the story, the tragic story of Karbala. So as I just told you previously, all the things that happens in literature, in plays, in paintings, all are done with the same aim, which is to make you think more and to have some different opinions and ideas upon the epic and tragic story of Karbala. So there's another ritual, which is mostly Persian ritual, that is called narration. You know, back in time when there was the ancient ages of Persian history, well, people used to go to tea houses, and then just as they were drinking their tea, an old man or just a young boy or an old man accompanied by a young boy would enter that tea house, and then they start telling stories from ancient Persian literature that is that deals mostly with epic stories that are very much famous in the literature of Iranian people. So that is very interesting. Just as you're sitting, you are drinking your tea, and then somebody is narrating a story for you with too much of passion. You know, the sort of their body language, the body language of the person who is retelling you these stories is very interesting. and it makes you involved in the story in a way that you feel like you are a part of that tragic epic. So little by little, as Islam flourished in Iran, since the greatest tragic story of the world is related to the Battle of Karbala and the story of Ashura, then these narrators started to narrate some stories from the battlefield of Karbala. Now, the funny part, the very interesting part about these sort of narration is that as time went by and everything started to be more flourish and developed, these narrators started to be accompanied by a curtain that was actually a painting. Just imagine a big canvas that is made of fabric. And then there is a great painting on it. And that painting is about the battlefield of Karbala. Those paintings are very beautiful because they, most of the time, they depict Imam Hussein alayhi salam as he has been in the battlefield and fighting those beasts. And then maybe there are some paintings related to his son, to his companions while they're in the battlefield. There are too much of horses in those paintings, and then blood, and then too much of the brutality of those beasts is pretty much vivid in those paintings. And the oppression of Imam Hussein alayhi salam and his companion is also is perfectly depicted in those paintings. Now, the narrator of the story of Karbala is going to use these curtains on the walls, or he would hang them somewhere on the wall, or by the help of some other tools, he would hang them on. And then in front of a crowd outside the tea houses that we talked about, or in the square of the streets, or somewhere just when there are plenty of people. You know, even I saw in a documentary that the narrator of these sort of paintings, of these sort of great paintings, would come into the very entrance of the city in the old times. And then just right there, when people are coming and going, he starts to narrate his story. And many people will come together and start to make a crowd in front of that painting where the narrator is telling the story of the battlefield of Karbala.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
The thing that is very interesting about these narration is the heroic language, the heroic voice that has been given to it. The person who is giving you the account of these paintings is actually pointing to every single being in that painting with too much of heroic voices. And they actually have a special method for reciting those stories. It's not just like I myself out of blue go there and then start to describe those paintings. No, it needs some special blessings. You have to work on it, you know. It seems that they have got some special methods. They have to learn it. They point at the good guys, at the good people with their hand, and they point with some sticks to the bad guys in order to make it clear that the bad guy is shown by the stick and the good guy is shown by their hand. So as a form of respect, you know, in order to show more of respect to the honorable people that they are showing in those paintings. So just like the plays that are related to the vast literature of Ashura, these sort of narrations that exist as a ritual in Persian history is also something very interesting, something that has got such a very great respect, because it is a ritual that gives you so much of time to ponder, and it gives you so much of idea. It talks about the themes of Karbala. It talks about the characteristics of each person that has been involved in the battlefield of Karbala, the good side of the battle and the evil side of the battle. I wish you do not forget us from your prayers. I hope you enjoyed today's session. Thank you for staying with us. Until another session, I bid you farewell.
Every grain of sand in every desert land he knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand he knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash he knows. Every thought I have and every word I share he knows.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.